Welcome to EIR Talks. On May 28, 2002, Democratic Party presidential pre-candidate Lyndon H. LaRouche, speaking from Germany, held an international webcast entitled How to Win the Peace, with a live audience in Washington, D.C. and New York, New York. This week we bring you the conclusion of his opening remarks to the worldwide audiences, as well as questions from many sources.
So what you see here is the crossover point. You see, what the employment is down, manufacturing employment, that's real employment. Farmers would show a most disastrous effect. Corporate profits fluctuating. The debt rising, level rising, but the U.S. money supply is being increased more rapidly than the financial markets are rising. So at that point, you've hit a point which has a historical precedent, a very important one. Germany, 1923. Germany was doing the similar kind of thing then to prop up the Reichsmark while it was trying to pay off the so-called war reparations debt. Up until the spring of 1923, there was inflation, but not a chaotic or hyperinflationary bubble. Suddenly, in June, July, of 1923, the bubble exploded. And by that time, later in November, the German Reichsmark was bankrupt. So what happened here, what you're seeing here, is something similar to what happened in Germany in 1923. Now you see on the markets today, if you pay attention to what the reports are from around the world, since Enron collapsed, it is now apparent that every time you were told there was a recovery in sight or signs of recovery in the international markets or the U.S. economy, it was faked. The figures have all been faked. And right now, especially this week, the figures on the amount of this fakery are beginning to come tumbling out. There never was a recovery. There never was a genuine uptick. And it happened just already today. Day starts out, market's going up, but then you find out the reason the profits are increased, they said, without mentioning expenses. And the firm had the biggest loss ever. And that kind of fakery. So people today in the United States are faced with the fact, there is no recovery, there never was a recovery, and under this system, there never will be a recovery. The world is going into the biggest depression in modern history, at least since the 17th century, right now. And the gold price was up to what? About $5 in one day. That's not an increase in the value of gold. That's a decrease in the value of the U.S. dollar. We are now in a depression which is worse than what you were in 1929, 1933. It's happening. It is presently irreversible. Anything they try to do to prevent it will only make things worse. But there are solutions. Now, here's where the hard thing comes. What is the solution? If you look at the history of the United States and the world, from 1945 to 1965, that is the so-called post-war recovery period, and you look at the United States from 1966 to the present, you will see that's why I use these figures, 66. Because the economy we had in the post-war reconstruction in the United States, Europe, Japan, and to some degree South and Central America, that was a real recovery, a success. There were a lot of problems with it, a lot of injustices. But in terms of economic figures as such, it was a success. It was real. It was actually increasing the productive powers of labor. More was produced. More was available. Consumption standards improved. That sort of thing. But 1966 on, it stopped. We began to slide down, and the rate of downslide accelerated. It was accelerated at a fast rate under Nixon. 1971, Nixon took the dollar off the gold reserve system, created a floating exchange rate system. The U.S. economy has never recovered from the effects of that. Then came along Brzezinski. Don't blame Carter. Carter was president, but he was only the president. Brzezinski ran the show. Under Brzezinski's dictatorship, from 1977 to 1981, the destruction of basic economic infrastructure and regulation in the United States has caused the greatest destruction of the U.S. economy in all history, in total amount. That destruction has continued with Grand Saint Germain, with Camp Roth, and with other arrangements. It continued. We looted Europe. We looted Russia in particular after 1989, 1991. And we got by with a lot because we were able to loot countries. We looted Europe. Europe became, when the Soviet power collapsed, Europe became less powerful because now it was at the mercy of the Anglo-American interests. And the looting of Germany and of continental Europe really took off at that point. Russia was looted beyond belief. Poland has been looted beyond belief. The Poles would be happy to have communist Poland back the gate today. The same thing as most of Eastern Europe, the same thing. Around the world, look at Japan. Japan is about ready to blow. There is a healthy industrial economy inside Japan, but the entire financial system, which is supporting the United States, is about to collapse. Look at the ASEAN countries, other countries. The collapse is fully underway. We are now in a worldwide collapse, which has been caused by a change in the world system, from a system with imperfections, but which nonetheless worked, from 1940, the post-Roosevelt system. The system was actually built by Roosevelt. From 1945 to 65, we had an economy, a real one, with policies that actually worked. Since 1966, we've gone step by step into an economy that doesn't work. Now it's collapsed. The amount of debt which is outstanding today could never be paid. We are sitting on top of a real estate bubble collapse in the United States today. The Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac bubble is about to blow. What day it's going to blow, I don't know. But it's going to blow. People are going to find that houses which they have listed as mortgages at $500,000 or so, plus or minus, in the Washington, D.C. area or the New York area, these shacks would probably be lucky to go for $100,000 redeemable value. People are going to be wiped out. Jobs are going to be wiped out. Firms are going to be closed down. What is the government going to do? It's going to happen. Well, if you had a Franklin Roosevelt in there, you'd know what you'd do. You'd freeze what you had to freeze. You'd put the country through bankruptcy reorganization. You'd restore the fixed exchange rate monetary system. And believe me, we could get it through quick right now. You would put regulation worldwide, regulation of trade, a new tariff system, a protectionist system. We would make sure that people were not fired. We'd keep banks from closing their doors, even if they're bankrupt, to keep the trade going. We would keep people employed, and the government would turn around and start a large-scale mass employment program based on infrastructure to stimulate the regrowth of the entire economy. We would do that in cooperation with nations around the world, which are now desperate. And if the United States said we're willing to do it, if, for example, if I were president right now, every one of them would say, yes. They'd agree with everything I say. They wouldn't even know half of what things I'm talking about, but they would agree with it nonetheless. Because in a time like this, they're looking for leadership. They want credible leadership that knows what it's talking about and is willing to act and is trustworthy in the sense that it will act. If they find that, they're going to say, okay, we're working with you. And we'll sit down and we'll discuss the details of what we're going to do. And they do. So what we need now is a mobilization of courage from among not too courageous leaders around the world and from the people who will push them. We can get out of this mess. We've dealt with messes before. Organizing and reorganizing a financial system, a monetary system, is not the greatest thing in the world. It's a tough thing. It will take us 25 years to repair the damage to the world, and the United States in particular, done by the changes of the past years. We can do it. We'll do it with methods which are not dissimilar entirely from what Franklin Roosevelt did beginning 1933. It worked then. The post-war version of Roosevelt, which is a diluted version, also worked. It'll work again. We rebuilt Europe with people like Monet, Jean Monnet, and so forth in the post-war period. We can do it again. We can work with Russia, and we can rebuild Russia. We have tremendous potential markets in China, in Southeast Asia, India, and so forth. If we build the system which they need to do the development which they need, and they represent, therefore, the markets that we need for the products we can produce that they need. And if we have a 25-year credit program among nations to do that, we can pull this nation and the world out of the mess. We have to decide, however, what kind of a world we want to build. Not a world in which we tell everybody how to run their government. Not a world in which we tell who you're a rogue state, you're not a rogue state. Or you're a rogue state tomorrow, but not today, or whatever. We need a world in which we agree that there are several simple principles. That every people has the right to be self-governed by a perfectly sovereign form of nation-state republic. That the policy of the United States is that which Secretary of State at the time, John Quincy Adams, said to the nations of South America and to the world. As soon as the United States has enough muscle to do it, we're going to kick the British and the Habsburgs out of the Americas, and we're going to establish a community of principle among perfectly sovereign nation states. We have to say the same thing today to the world. What the world we want is not a world of our design. It's not a world in which we become the dictator or the emperor. What we need is a world which is composed of perfectly sovereign nation states, which in their own mutual interest will cooperate and will establish principles, a community of principles of agreement. Right now we've got a big job. Rebuild the world economy, make the world a safe place to live in, economically. I think we can succeed. But who's, I'm willing to do it, who else is? Thank you.
Nice to have somebody who's willing to do it, who knows how to do it. While we are working to get one of our questioners on the phone right now, I'm going to ask Mr. LaRouche a question that was submitted yesterday by a member of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. This person is a member of the professional staff of that committee that, as most of you I think know, operates within the Congress of the United States. His question is the following. He says, Mr. LaRouche, Joe Lieberman has emerged as the leading Democratic contender for the presidential nomination in 2004. Over the past few weeks, Senator Lieberman has emerged with a strident defense of the new economy. It's very hard for those of us who are preparing for the midterm elections to explain why it is that the leading Democratic contender for the presidential nomination is doing that. It has left us somewhat outside the circle of reality. Do you have any idea what Lieberman is doing and why he is doing it?
Lieberman is a very strange animal. He's a very intelligent person, as contrasted, and I don't think he has quite as many short circuits as McCain does. But his ties to McCain are intricate and extremely exotic. We have to look at this at what, you know, Arizona has some very strange things in it, apart from Gila monsters. And it has organized crime connections, and quasi, like the Joe Bonanno connection, which used to be the drug, used to be a drug pusher setting up for the mob in Canada, tied with Sam Bronfman. And there was a big scandal up there in the 1950s about Bonanno and drugs and John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, and so forth, which caused the fall of a government up there, a Canadian government. So the thing is rotten. You have this Empress thing, the murder of the Bolles in Arizona. You have scandals about Indian reservation gambling concessions. You have big questions raised about John Irwin III, there, the biggest landowner, or one of the biggest landowners in the state, the grandson of a former governor of the state, and also a member of the IBM family, of the Watson family, who runs some very nasty operations under his American Family Foundation and other things. And this is a very messy thing. Now, when you look at this closely, you find that John McCain says he's a bull moose, and all we're getting is a lot of flap. He says he is a Republican or he's not a Republican or whatnot. And Lieberman and McCain are almost like twins. So you have a faction. McCain says he's a loyal Republican. Lieberman says he's a loyal Democrat. We find both of them are hybrids. We don't know what party they belong to when you look at their issues and you look at their connections. And some of their connections really worry me. They really worry me from a standpoint of ethics, shall we say. But also, Lieberman is something else. In a case like this, you have to look at a person by their policy and what their hands and feet do. And Joe's bad. We have this, for example, Joe's intelligent enough to know what he's doing. And that's bad. Because what he's doing is he's a supporter of a fascist movement in the United States. This fascist movement is associated with people like Wolfowitz and so forth. It's associated with Samuel P. Huntington, with Zbigniew Brzezinski, and people like that. It's a movement which, in the post-war period, proposed a military reform called the Utopian Reform, which is based on the model, in fact, of the Nazi International Waffen-SS. That is to produce a professional army, no longer a citizen army, but a professional army which would do the enforcing like the Roman legions or the Waffen-SS for the command. And this is well known. As soon as they could get rid of MacArthur, which they did fairly quickly in the post-war period, then they got rid of Eisenhower when he resigned from office. And you know what happened when Eisenhower resigned or retired? All the things, all the cats and dogs and squirrels and Gila monsters and so forth that had been hiding in the cages came loose in 1961. Eisenhower steps out of office. All over the world, assassinations, coup d'etats, all sorts of things. Usually pointing toward Alan Dulles as one of the perpetrators in these things, or Colonel Lansdale. We had an assassination movement against de Gaulle in France in 1962. We had a very suspicious overthrow of the Macmillan government in England, in the so-called Profumo scandal, in the same period. We had the early ouster of Adenauer in Germany. We had other assassinations. We had the Kennedy assassination. Different kinds of Mattei assassination. And suddenly by 1965, with the ouster of Erhard in Germany by another kind of coup d'etat, you had a change in the world. The United States had gone into the Indochina War, which is the kind of war, the no-win perpetual war, prescribed by the Brzezinski, Kissinger, Huntington, and so forth types. The world had changed. In the middle of the 1960s, we stopped being a producer society, and we went to, by recruiting our youth into what was called post-industrial society, or sometimes it was known as the rock, drug, sex counterculture. We began to, and this was particularly concentrated upon the most vulnerable part of the youth, the university-educated youth. If you corrupt the students in the leading universities of a country by this kind of program, you will do grave damage to the existence of the nation as a whole, because these are the guys who are going to move into the secondary positions in professions and in management. And if you destroy the people who are going to run the country by tradition, you're going to ruin the country. And it did, worked. It worked just fine. We destroyed the country with the aid of the baby boomer generation. Those that came into maturity or semi-maturity or immaturity, whatever the case may be, in the middle of the 1960s. We destroyed them. We put them on drugs. We made them crazy. We told them industrial society was no good, and we used the threat of the draft over their heads to scare them, you know, bring out their native cowardice and get them into the kind of things they did. So we destroyed the United States. We became a consumer society. In 1966, 1967, we shut down a lot of the space program, which was the major technology driver for the United States at that time. By 1969, we could no longer build the space shot. We had destroyed so much of the industry essential to the space shot, we couldn't have replicated it, the man on the moon. Right? That's what we did to ourselves. So we became a consumer society, which, as I've described it before, is like Rome, like ancient Rome. During the period of the Second Punic War and afterward, Rome underwent a change in character from a Roman society into a consumer society, an imperial consumer society. It extensive use of slavery. They turned the people into pigs, the citizens, to bread and circuses. That is mass entertainment, very much like our television entertainment today, but they didn't have television screens, so they used stadiums to get Christians to eat lions or something. Yeah? That sort of thing. And this kind of mass entertainment destroyed the morality of the Roman people, who no longer worked for a living. They lived on bread and circuses, on entertainment and dole. They destroyed the civilization. Rome lived by looting other countries. How do you think the United States lived over the period from 1966? We destroyed our industries, and with the help of the floating exchange rate system and reforms introduced under Carter, we became the greatest looter of other nations on this planet. The United States has been living, like the Romans, by looting countries that are afraid not to concede to its demands. That's how currencies were rigged. That's how runs on currencies were created. That's how the Latin American debt was created, by stealing, by fraud. Fraud practiced largely by the United States with the help of Britain. They'd make a run on a currency. The IMF would come in like the shock troops, like the Nazi SS, tell the country to devalue its currency, but increase its debts to make up for the devaluation. And they looted South America. What they did to Africa since 1966 is unconscionable. We have mass murder and genocide all over Africa run by the British, the United States, and certain Israeli operations, including Barrick Gold, which is an investment of the father of the present president of the United States. Genocide all over Africa. We're doing the same thing in other parts of the world. We've been looting the world. We looted Japan with the Big Bang. We got the Japanese to print currency to bail out our financial markets. And they're going bankrupt as a result of it. And the Japanese are afraid to say no. We're destroying the world with this system, and we're trying to set up a military system based on an American people who were uneducated, highly opinionated, but ignorant, with no particular skills for any kind of skilled work, who have lost the skills, the jobs have run overseas. The farm area is a disaster area, psychologically and morally, because of what's been done to the farmers. Industrial centers of the United States have been destroyed, and the people in them have been largely destroyed. We don't have families anymore. We don't even have latchkey children. Our children are being destroyed by the social system which is being developed. We took away people's health care. We stole it from them. We're condemning them to death because we want to get rid of excess population. The best way to do it is to cut back through the HMO program. You'll increase the death rate quite nicely. The shutting down of DC General Hospital is typical of the example of this kind of process. So you have a policy centered in the Democratic Leadership Council, which Joe Lieberman represents, as Al Gore did. And this crew is behind this policy. They're behind the so-called new economy policy, which is just blown out. This country is no longer the nation that produced Martin Luther King. It's a different kind of a nation. And Lieberman represents that. So what we're dealing here, you're dealing with the inertia of a guy who is an ambitious, savagely ambitious person, completely untrustworthy and slimy, controlled by you know not whom. This guy is running for the top position of the Democratic Party in the United States, and is effectively, ever since Jeffers resigned from the Republican Party, the Congress doesn't work. because you have an alliance in the Congress typified by the McCain-Lieberman alliance, with Daschle going along with it, and the Congress can't get through a decent piece of legislation. No, a couple of things get through there if the President of the United States wants them at the time. But so you have a system that doesn't work. So the Lieberman problem is this, very simple. Lieberman has to go. Let him sit in the Senate. If Connecticut wants to support him, let him support him. But he does not, should not run the Democratic Party. We have to take over the Democratic Party. Because there are a lot of good people in there, but they believe that they have to go along with the leaders. Well, I don't know. I don't want to bring the guillotine in or something like that, but I think we do have to have some change of leadership around there. And people like the questioner knows what I mean. We have to get our gumption up. We have, and the people will support us. Don't kid yourself. They will support us. The American people, now that it's clear to them that this whole recovery was a fraud, a big financial fraud, that don't trust an accountant. Never believe an accountant. You gave up on lawyers, now you can give up on accountants too. Right? So in this kind of situation, I think the American people, if they sense there's a movement, and I know the American people from a long time. I knew their grandpappies. I knew what's inside them. And the American people see with a sense that this is the crisis, that this is the time to stop moving. We can make earthquakes, political earthquakes throughout the country. And the good Democrats inside the Democratic Party can take over the Democratic Party. And they'll find cooperation from any good Republicans they find loose on the landscape. We can change this. The world is ready to accept a certain kind of leadership initiative from the United States. And if we show the gumption to our people inside the United States, into the world, that we're ready to take that step, you'll find that people who've been spitting at us will suddenly come to like us and cooperate with us.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with a continuation of Lyndon LaRouche's international webcast of May 28, 2002. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We continue with Lyndon LaRouche's international webcast of May 28, 2002.
The next question will be a question that we take from our studio audience. I'd like to call to the microphone Mr. Zoran Dimitrovsky, who is the U.S. correspondent for the Macedonian daily Veser.
Okay, hello. I would like to ask you, Mr. LaRouche, actually, to turn his attention on the issue of war and peace, actually, the security in Balkans, because over the past 10 years, we did have three wars on Balkans in Bosnia, in Croatia, and in Kosovo, actually, in Macedonia last year. So we do have three peace agreements there, but we do not have peace in a sense that there will be no more extremism there and attacks. So last week we did have a Kosovo parliament resolution which does not recognize the borders, the border agreement between two sovereign nations as Serbia and Macedonia are. Do you think that the role of the international community, actually the role of the United States and NATO, which are deeply involved in this crisis in Balkans, and the soldiers are there also, do you think that they're trying to stabilize the region, or they're doing just the opposite?
The policy involves this, someone who's very close to Brzezinski, Madeleine Albright, who also has a connection to Condoleezza Rice, of course, of the now the president's teacher or something, a schoolmarm. And they all have this common feature through the teacher of Condoleezza Rice, Joseph Caldwell, who's the father of Madeleine Albright. They all have a common feature. And if you look at the common feature, then you understand exactly what's going on. These people are followers of a policy which was pulled together in 1928 around a book by H.G. Wells called The Open Conspiracy. The Open Conspiracy, which was joined immediately by Bertrand Russell, has been the basis, the center of the creation internationally of a proposal for a new Roman Empire, a new kind of Roman Empire, which you can find detailed in The Open Conspiracy, what the issues are. It was this group, Russell and Wells. Wells, you know, for 1913 was the first political figure, then as an official of the Fabian Society and an intelligence operative for the British government at the time, wrote a book in which he added a preface. The book was fictional, but the preface was not. And what he proposed was that radioactive weapons, which were now possible, and he referred to Frederick Soddy's proposal on radium bombs, that these should be used as a weapon so terrible that governments would give up their sovereignty to world government in order to avoid national wars. This became was a continued policy of Wells and of Russell. It was Russell and Wells and their group, including the Unification Sciences Group of the United States, the development of cybernetics, the development of all these things by the same group, the development of the drug programs in the United States, all these things came from this group, to destroy the sovereign nation state, to create, in effect, a new world government, a new Roman Empire of a new style, in which an elite, typified by Wells and Russell themselves, would actually run the world as an elite. Now, this is the kind of thing you would see in a film that was done in the 1930s, composed by Wells, called The Shape of Things to Come, in which this kind of world empire, post-war world empire, was proposed with super weapons. Now, what this means is, in deciding a new Roman Empire, it means that you declare certain areas of the world as border areas, or what the Romans call limes, the boundaries. What has been designated is to take the former Yugoslavia with some adjoining states and destroy it, to turn it into a no man's land, a limes. Now what they've done is they've gone in and run us in after the conclusion of the Desert Storm operations. And the reason the United States pulled out of Iraq in Desert Storm is because they wanted to get the Balkan War started. That's why it happened. You want to know why they stopped the war in Iraq? They wanted to get the Balkan War started. And Powell, who was then in charge of the operation, said, no, we cannot overextend ourselves. So they decided to go into the Balkan Wars. So the Balkan War is the intention to destroy the Balkans. A limes principle. Just as the declaration by Brzezinski, who's also a follower of this H.G. Wells philosophy, he's a fascist just like the rest of them, is to destroy Islam and to make Islam a limes area. By declaring Islam as an outlaw, a free fire zone, you can destroy and control the countries which border on Islam. You can control Central Asia. You can destroy China. And one of the long-term objectives of this is destroy China. But the way you do it is the way the Romans did it with their limes policy, the Roman Empire. You use military forces as legionnaires of the professional army of the type described by Huntington and company. Use that kind of army, which is our special warfare army, deployed in every part of the world, using naval power and air power over the territory, just the way navies used to be used in the old days, and troops going in, hit-and-run troops, operations, guerrilla warfare, so forth, playing one side against the other. So the intention here, on the part of this faction in Britain and in the United States, a faction typified by Madeleine Albright, her father Joseph Caldwell, and Brzezinski, is to destroy the Balkans. So what happened, as you know, the Kosovo destabilization, in the case of Albania, was organized by the British and by Madeleine Albright to create precisely the problems which Macedonia faces now. And the best thing I can say practically, of course, my attitude about this is obvious. What I think should be done is obvious. My answer is we should be developing the Balkans with large-scale projects, because the Balkans is an essential part of the underbelly of Europe as a whole. If you wish to develop Europe effectively, if you wish to develop the connections, the trade connections, the economic connections to the Middle East and other parts of Asia, you develop the Balkans. With
Lynn?
Transportation, develop...
Lynn?
Yes.
Our elaborate signal system has not operated, but I'm going to ask you to hold on for just a second. I apologize. We will come back to this question. But we have on the phone right now Colonel Mohammed Senaldine, who is a distinguished military hero. He led his nation's troops during the Malvinas War. He is speaking to us today from a prison in Argentina. And therefore, I'm sure you understand
en línea y está hablándonos desde Argentina, desde una cárcel de la prisión. Adelante, coronel.
Queridísimo hermano, señor, amigo y pensador de la humanidad, don Lindo Larús.
My great brother, friend of humanity, my good friend, Lindo Larús.
Les habla el coronel Mohamed Ali Zainaldin desde la prisión militar de Campo de Mayo.
This is Colonel Mohamed Ali Zainaldin speaking to you from the prison, military prison camp of Campo de Mayo.
En la República Argentina.
In the Republic of Argentina.
Quien le hace llegar con un fuertísimo abrazo.
Who sends you a very warm embrace.
Mi inmensa alegría de compartir a sus órdenes.
And my tremendous joy of being able to share in your orders.
Esta dura pero maravillosa lucha.
This hard but marvelous struggle.
Para bien de la humanidad y por un mundo mejor.
For the good of humanity and for a better world.
Tenga la absoluta seguridad que desde Iberoamérica.
You can be absolutely certain that from Iberoamérica.
Junto a comunes amigos. Lorenzo y Marivilla Carrasco.
Together with.
Gerardo Terán y otros muchos.
Together with our common friends, Marivilla Carrasco, Lorenzo Carrasco, Gerardo Terán, and many others,
luchamos por el triunfo de sus ideas y proyectos.
We are struggling for the triumph of your ideas and your projects.
Que ya están siendo aceptados y difundidos en todos los ámbitos.
Which are now being accepted and propagated throughout all circles.
Una de las pruebas más palpables es la integración realizada entre Brasil y Argentina.
One of the most evident facts of this is the integration we have achieved between Argentina and Brazil.
La que avanza con mucha fuerza y con mucha fe.
Which is advancing with a lot of strength and with a lot of faith.
Otra es la aceptación sin duda de su propuesta económica.
And the other one is the acceptance without a doubt of your economic proposal.
Único salvavidas ante el descalabro terminal de los estados nacionales iberoamericanos.
Which is the only lifesaver for those nations of Iberoamerica which are currently being destroyed.
Y por último, para no extenderme más.
Finally, so as not to extend myself too much.
Sepa que trabajamos llevando la bandera de su maravilloso mensaje de unidad.
Be aware of the fact that we are working with the message, your message, for unity.
Unidos o vencidos.
Either we join together or we would be hung together.
La alternativa en esta hora crucial del mundo es.
The alternative we face in this crucial moment.
O seguimos con la destrucción de la humanidad que lleva adelante el establishment internacional. Los Bush, los Soros, los Kissinger, etc.
either we continue with the destruction of the world that has been carried out by the international establishment, the Bushes, the Kissingers, the Soros, etc.,
o levantamos la bandera de la reconstrucción del mundo,
or we lift the standard of the reconstruction of the world,
con el señor y patriarca Don Lindo LaRouche,
with the gentleman and patriarch Lyndon LaRouche.
Ruego a Dios y María de la Merced,
I pray to God and to Mary of Mercies,
para que triunfe el bien que es usted,
for the good that you represent, to triumph,
y salvemos a la humanidad y la especie humana,
and we can save humanity and the human species,
del peligro en que hoy se encuentran,
of the danger in which it faces today.
Por Dios y la gran patria iberoamericana,
for God and the great Ibero-American fatherland,
Mohamed Ali Zeineldin,
Mohamed Ali Zeineldin,
ex coronel,
former colonel, okay,
nada
más. Nothing else, thank you.
Dean, we look forward to the day when we can host you here in Washington.
Coronel Zeineldin, estamos esperando el día en que podamos tenerte aquí en Washington, ser tus anfitriones en Washington.
Con todo cariño, yo les agradezco y estaré al lado de ustedes como estoy ahora espiritualmente. Muchas gracias por esta atención que han tenido comunicarme con el señor Lindo LaRouche.
With my entire pleasure, I am looking forward to that opportunity, and thank you very much for having given me the opportunity to speak to Mr. Lindo LaRouche.
Exactly. Thank you very much, Councilor Lee.
Muchas gracias a usted, Coronel Zeineldin.
Lynn.
Muchas gracias.
Lynn, would you like to say anything?
Well, I just said this is, it speaks for itself. I mean, what can I say? Can you top this?
That was certainly a treat. Before I take our next question, Lynn, before I interrupted you, do you have anything that you want to go back to on that previous question, or shall we move ahead?
Oh, just one final point, is that what is needed is a contrary policy to the present policy. I think Europeans would tend to support it, except without U.S. pressure to the contrary. And that is the idea that there should be a development project with the idea that the whole region below the Danube, to the Mediterranean, to the and to the Black Sea, should be a development area with large-scale projects linked with the idea that this is the natural underbelly of Europe, and therefore it should be developed as a with its economic potential as the underbelly. And I think the nonsense would stop. I think the military nonsense could be controlled. There are forces who would very much love to control this mess, but the United States and Britain won't let them. If the United States and Britain would let these forces act, the mess would be cleaned up. You would have stability, and you would if there was a commitment to an economic development program, it would work, and that's what the area needs.
Okay. The next question is one that has been submitted by the Youth Committee of the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. That question is as follows. Mr. LaRouche, we are rapidly approaching the summer, and we are doing so in a period not only of economic collapse, but also of social collapse. There are almost no jobs available for inner city youth, and we are faced with large numbers of idle youth during hot weather under very bad conditions. We are extremely concerned as to what the plight of American cities will be during these summer months, particularly given the fact that we fear that current Attorney General John Ashcroft and the people around him will use this situation to consolidate top-down control. We are not convinced that the situation in America's cities will not become the equivalent of the kind of treatment that is currently being meted out to Palestinians in the Middle East. We are not sure whether or not Homeland Security or the policy that you've referred to as the U.S. NORTHCOM operation is relevant to this or not. But either way, we believe that we face a significant problem this summer. Do you have any thoughts on this?
It's very all true. First of all, but you have to look at this historically. You have to look at this in a strategic, historic way, not just an issue way, because it's much bigger than any issue in the particular sense. What the U.S. government is tending to do now, under present economic and strategic policies, particularly since the reaction to September 11th, especially since the beginning of this year, the United States has embarked on a course which cannot be maintained unless the United States becomes a fascist state in the full sense of the term Nazi. The elements are there. The tendencies are there. You had, for example, in Germany, you had the comparison of 1931 to 32 before 1933. You had these movements which were all moving already in a direction toward establishing a totalitarian state. The British and certain people in New York decided to make Hitler and his movement the choice. Hitler was bankrupt. He was about ready to fold up in December of 1932. And money from New York, from Harriman, now that great Democrat, and his circles, through the British circles, went to bail out the Nazi Party and kept it alive. And through those same influences with von Papen and others, they got the president of Germany to put Hitler into the chancellery on January 30th of 33, just shortly before the time that Roosevelt was going to be inaugurated in the United States. Now, if that had not happened, Germany would have adopted the same policy or similar policies to those of Franklin Roosevelt for recovery. In that case, no war would have ever occurred. No Nazism would have ever occurred. Now we're facing a similar situation in the United States itself. If this were to continue unabated, the United States would become a fascist terror state in the full sense of the word. And the Homeland Defense and other measures would be instruments used to bring that into place. Ashcroft has already made moves in that direction, whether he understands it or not. The irony of the situation is this. The United States is now embarked under the current president. I don't think he knows what's happening to him, but he's going along with it because I guess Condoleezza tells him it's all right. But he's embarked on the Roman model to set up a Roman Empire based on English-speaking interests to rule the world as a Roman Empire. The problem here is that when the Roman Empire was established, Rome was at the height of its power in the Mediterranean region. This empire is attempting to be established at a time that the United States is at its weakest internally worldwide. It is ready to collapse. We are in an economic crisis, a monetary financial crisis, which can mean a total collapse, a physical collapse. The United States is trying to run wars all over the world. It does not have the capability of mobilizing for wars all over the world. It has nuclear bombs, thermonuclear bombs. It has bombers, which are aging somewhat. It is producing some new hardware in factories which need a bailout because Bush's friends have interest in those stock in those factories. But for the economy itself, there is no basis, there is no war economy. So the idea that the United States could repeat the Hitler war economy model is not true. The United States is in worse condition today as an economy than Germany was in the beginning of the 1930s. It cannot do what the Nazis did. So under these conditions, with a breakdown of the system, and more of the world not only frightened but hating the United States and these policies, we're at a point where nothing is a foregone conclusion. If we decide, if enough people around the world decide this is not going to happen, it will not happen. But if we don't decide that, it will happen. If we do not decide to change the present economic system,
back to the kind of model that Franklin Roosevelt represented over 1933 through the continuation of his policies in partial form through 1965. There is no hope for the United States, nor is there any hope for any of these problems. We are not going to solve any of these problems unless we have a change in the general economic policy of the United States, a fundamental swing away from the policies of the past 35 years to the policies more in keeping with the Roosevelt administration and post-war reconstruction. Without that, there's not a chance for the United States. That's why I spoke of courage today, because there is no middle ground. There is no compromise. You cannot compromise with Satan when hell's under siege. And that's the problem. We have to move forth positively, not just negatively, not against things that are bad. That won't work. You've got to move for things that are good. You must, in a time of crisis, not run around screaming how bad it is. You must inspire confidence by coming forth with programs which actually will give you the new kind of system which will deal with the problems. And that's what's needed. We must take over the Democratic Party right now. And as many Republicans who want to come along, we're welcome.
Lynn, the next question, which is kind of a statement and a question, it was submitted by Monsignor Robert Hupp, who is the Director Emeritus of Boys Town in Omaha, Nebraska. He writes, "Dear Lynn, it is useful in times like these to have a lifespan as you and I do, and as does our beloved friend Pope John Paul II, of something just short of a century. It also helps to be punching a time clock that reads eternity rather than any particular day or hour. So then you're looking at any event with a vision of the eternal rather than just reacting to things. It also helps to have a lot of guts. Look at the Holy Father. He's apologized for everything from the Crusades to the Inquisition and for the abuse of any child, whether by abortion, starvation, or sex. We should be spreading his example. His apologies have been some of the most important additions to the moral authority of the Roman Catholic Church. Look around and see that all of our major institutions, from the White House to St. Peter's, are under attack. Then ask, as I do, and as the bishops' meeting in Dallas next week must do, who benefits from this mob mentality, screaming against the institution of the Catholic Church? Crucify him, crucify him. Now, you know that I am no newcomer to uncovering cover-ups. In 1973, after observing the goings-on of a new assistant assigned to me 1 week before, I went to the then Archbishop and told him to do something about this guy. Anyone who could face up to what was going on could see it. But it was only last year, after decades of blinders-wearing bureaucracies, that anyone took this guy on. Today, he is sitting in a jail cell in Lincoln, Nebraska. I was ready to deal with it after 1 week. And of course, you know that when I went to Boys Town and had to have a 24-hour-a-day police guard because I was cleaning up that mess, some people chose to use me for target practice. On one hand, you can roll up your sleeves, wade into the pig pen, and clean it up. Or on the other hand, you start letting the wildlife manage the humans. In Wisconsin this week, the TV news was going after some priest's allegedly miserable sins. He died 12 years ago. And the news went out to the cemetery and broadcast pictures of his grave. I'd say they're really working hard to dig something up. So in light of our combined ages, experiences, and courage, I think a couple of things are worth bringing up before those young fellows meet in Dallas next week. One is the interesting article that appeared in EIR magazine about some really big sinners on the Pentagon side of the Beltway in what some people have been calling the Robert Hansen Diocese, sometimes known as Utopia. The other is some things that Mother Teresa spoke to some of us about, which we should be thinking about at a time like this. Among one of the useful things I did was to have introduced one of your female officer corps to Mother Teresa while that saint was still walking this earth. I assume he means Mother Teresa. Many of us had recognized the difference in quality of religious vocations when the 60s rolled around. It was quite a bit different than what we had dealt with before, and we're seeing some of the fruits and nuts of it now. Your lieutenant talked with Mother Teresa, as she also did with me, about how at the very beginning of these roaring 60s, while these kids were still wearing beards and beads, I never had a beard. You developed an inoculation so that they could walk through Sodom and its sister cities and not be infected or afraid. Mother Teresa spoke of what you taught these kids as being like the sign of the cross drawn with the living ashes of repentance, which would allow these young people to spread to others your inoculation against the moral decay surrounding them. This is preparation to live in eternal reality instead of what they call these days virtual reality. This is how these young people continue to fend off the ravages of the terrible disease baby boomeritis and lead their generation today. When Mother Teresa talked about how you did this, one could not forget it, since she was very funny, very blunt, and often very embarrassing. I'm bringing these things up right now because I think we older fellows might be able to give some of the younger ones who are preparing for their meeting in Dallas next week some good advice. They sure could use it.
You've been listening to EIR Talk's presentation of Lyndon LaRouche's international webcast of May 28, 2002. To hear a rebroadcast or to read a transcript, go to www.larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.